Cliff Central Revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.
Robert Berta works as a consultant for an ethical consultancy specializing in executive coaching, diplomatic training, and anti-corruption, amongst other things. He also runs an NGO in the social justice space. However, for today's purposes, he describes himself as just someone who has written an unlikely and thought-provoking poem about a very special person, a woman, probably a domestic worker, standing at a gate. A gate in time. Robert, welcome to the Mate Sessions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. So I think it's always powerful for a poet to read a poem in the tone and manner that they intended it. So if you wouldn't mind, could you grace us with a reading of the poem?
Thank you very much. I stand at your gate, madam. On time, 7:30 Saturday, as requested. It's cold. It's taken time, 2 hours to be exact, to wake, to wash, to walk, taxi 1, bus 1, taxi 2, to walk, at your gate, 7:30 Saturday, on time, as requested. Your convenience, madam. But you forgot. You are sleeping. Your phone is off. What must I do? Shout? Will you hear? Hundreds of years frustration. Servant, servitude, at your gate. 7:30 Saturday, on time. Waiting for you to wake up. Change is coming for you, for me. But I suspect that while your color may change, I will still be at your gate, waiting for you to wake up. But you, madam, will still be sleeping. But I am, madam, on time.
Oh, that's amazing. There's something so special about a live reading by a poet. So thank you so much for that. I'm also very excited because when we reviewed the poem, I read it in a very similar tone. And it's hard to know the poem, the tone that was intended. And this is the difficulty with writing, is to convey tone through your words. And so you've obviously done that incredibly well, because I think I sort of intuitively read it in the same manner. Okay, so before we get into it, though, I would like you to tell us a bit more about yourself.
So I'm 52, middle-aged, guy trying to married with 4 children, working in the social justice space, running an NGO like many people in that space. It's a daily battle. I also run a consultancy practice together with some colleagues, and I'm trying to make sense, give meaning to where we at today, with a strong power and influence of the past and to some degree uncertainty about the future.
Wow. Okay. So I think that echoes a lot of what we try to do here on the show and what so many South Africans try to do. And I think there's something so beautiful about your medium of choice being poetry and being words. I mean, I think our national discourse is incredibly rich in words. People write articles, essays, books, but you've done something so beautiful here. And I almost think you're, in my mind, you're a unicorn. First of all, because you're a white male who's been able to channel a very complex and loaded reality. In such a profound way. And then secondly, to do so in so few words, when we're, like I said, like we have a discourse that is so verbose, and often those words don't really mean anything. So to capture such a rich conversation and such a rich narrative in so few words is absolutely amazing. And I just want to say that you are very modest, but I salute you from writer to writer. So thank you for this poem. So I don't want to do kind of an academic review. I mean, thematically, a lot of things stick out for me. But what I want is for you, in your own words, to describe what this poem is about.
So maybe just to contextualize, I think all poetry lies in the crevice of a soul. So the person who's writing, who's conveying the message, it finds itself within them, generally within the pain, the suffering, the shadows, the aspirations, the unknowns, and it articulates. It kind of has its life of its own. So with this particular poem, I was going to a breakfast meeting quite early, 7:30, And I saw this woman standing at a gate with a cell phone in her hand. And I'm often witnessing people at gates.
Mm.
I see young people scavenging for food out of dustbins. They're looking for plastic, or they're looking for paper. They're looking for something to salvage, or they're looking for food. And we kind of just unstructured, unsorted. We don't sort our junk. Mm. And so people, if we sorted our junk, then that kind of scavenging would make more sense, to be more meaning. And we don't have to have people eat rotten food. You could have proper food put out, small sensitivities and identification. So I think that I am in this process of experiencing people at gates. And so when I saw this woman standing in distress, it touched me at a very deep level, I think. And it went right into my childhood subconscious.
And you say that she's not necessarily a domestic worker. I noticed that. So you said in your – when I read your biography earlier, you said this was a poem about a woman, probably a domestic worker. And yet in our minds when we read it, it was speaking so directly to domestic work.
Well, in my mind, she was a domestic worker.
Yeah.
But I think there's always this sort of assumptions that we make about people.
Okay.
And I think that she was.
Okay.
I just had a sense of that, but that doesn't mean.
So is it correct then to say that the poem is about domestic work, for starters?
Well, as the writer of the poem, that was the impression
gotcha.
I had.
Gotcha. Anyway, so you were still explaining what it's about for you.
So I don't think that poetry is something that you cognitively sit down and think, I'm going to write something about this to make sense of it. It's somehow, well, for me anyway, it's something that already exists deep within you. And so you just sit down and then there's a flow of language, of words, of sound, rhythm, structure, nuance, and leveling. And it's all one thing. So I sat down where I was waiting for the meeting and I wrote this poem pretty much without changing anything. It was complete. And I'm glad I didn't know that it was going to be discussed, you know, because I would have probably not been able to write it with the simplicity and the distillation of rawness.
Okay, so you saw this woman, you assumed, like we all do, that she might be a domestic worker, and then set out to write a poem about domestic work, in a meeting, no less, which is absolutely amazing as well. What is your personal experience of domestic work in this country?
So I think that this is where the pain lies. I think this is where the complexity lies.
Mm.
And I think this is where we make so many errors of assumptions about people. This is where we are caught within the South African narrative of color, class, and gender.
Mm.
And they're very powerful issues that are structurally there, they are politically there, economically, historically, but they're very deeply embedded in the person, the personhood of South Africans. And so in that we go into a binary place of I'm the hero, I'm the victim, and yet the truth is much more complex than that.
It's a lot more gray than that.
Yeah. So as a child, I grew up probably with a strong identification of women working in our home and an emotional attachment to them.
Mm.
And I think that my consciousness of injustice was already processing itself. The disconnect between many things seemed wrong already for me. And because I was emotionally attached and I was in this deep feeling of love and care and being loved and being cared for, it was a love relationship as a child with a mother figure. I think that this echo in the discourse is missing. And I think I didn't intend to have this discussion.
Right.
It's just an echo that's come out.
Right.
And I think that the injustice lies in how women are treated in homes. They have no power. I can remember the woman working in our home One day they're there, the next day they're gone.
Mm.
And there wasn't any time to say goodbye, to grieve, to even understand why they're gone. And the power lying in my mother being able to dismiss the domestic worker for whatever subjective arbitrary reason she had, is in some ways deeply embedded in my understanding of society and the power dynamics in society and the injustice that goes with that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a small child in me trying to make sense of injustice and the grieving of emotional relationships that were lost, and that's how it reflects.
So do you think that goes for a lot of white males in South Africa? And I say white males because they're probably the least associated to this role, right? So you're, I mean, this is, and you say it yourself, you say this is an unlikely poem because you're a middle-aged white male, a consultant. And in many ways, the extreme opposite of what a domestic worker is in this country in terms of experience, perhaps in terms of privilege, whatever the case may be, even if those are just assumptions, right? And so do you feel like white men are written out of certain conversations as a result? Because they're deemed to not be able to relate or to come from a place of privilege.
I think that we living in a society of 2-minute noodles where everybody wants to have a very simplistic type immediate answer response. So in categorizing people as you are a white male, it has the same 2-minute noodle type effect as saying you are a black youth or you are a black domestic worker.
Mm.
These are labels that we give, but do they really reflect the character, the personality, the intelligence, the vocation, the calling, the purpose and identity of the person? We're looking at it from a very small lens, which is time, but that person has infinity in them. They have something of much bigger. And so, for example, yesterday I'm busy working, I was having a discussion with one of the cleaning staff, and this woman, I took time to ask her about herself and about, I'm interested. I want to know the person. And she's a graduate in public administration, but she could never get work. And now she's this middle-aged woman being trapped in doing work that it's not demeaning, it's not negative, it's just not satisfying for her. And she would have liked to have done something different. Every day she's doing the same thing over and over and over again. And it's hell. Mm. It's like a torture. She could have done something different. And the reason why she's trapped in that is for structural reasons,
right.
Historical injustice.
Right.
And I think that this interests me.
Okay. And so when you wrote this poem and when you engage in such matters, or when you vocalize them, or when you channel these experiences, which I think you do so well, is there any reluctance about your own, your place in the narrative, your own identity? Do you carry that kind of fear or frustration or self-doubt?
I think that even to say, you know, I think of myself as a poet, it seems fake because I don't think of myself like that. When I was a diplomat, am I a diplomat? I didn't feel that I was a diplomat. I'm working as an NGO. Am I a social justice activist? I don't feel that.
Mm.
My identity isn't really in these labels. So, because these labels are, in many ways, don't reflect the complexity and the depth and my existence, but they're merely mirrors of where I am. And so, yes, there is, but I think that anybody who's above in middle age is in a state of reflection and crisis of some sort, whether what you've done with your life has made sense and could you have done it differently. And I think that it's a normal part of our journey of maturing.
But I think that what makes your reflection, for instance, so rich is that your idea of yourself is so fluid. You haven't constructed yourself per se. And do you think that in a sense that, because we're a country and a culture that profiles. It's how we kind of make sense of things. And there is value in profiling to some extent. But I think it can also get in the way. So do you think that, identification or identity in a sense can get in the way of empathy? So do you think that people can presume that they can't identify with somebody and can't write a poem like this? Well, because they're too different.
I think it's because we take on identity as labels given to us by other people. I think we're in an existentialist crisis with identity because, first of all, identity and is not located within just a time base from cradle to grave. It comes from a different place. It comes from a infinite space. So I'm always interested in this tension, this dissonance between the cosmic dance of infinity within the dust and in the sand of time. And I think that this
is that spiritual?
Deeply spiritual.
Okay.
And I think it is the loneliness and the separation from innocence, from perfection, from greatness, from intimate love and belonging. And I think that separation is what makes for creativity. It is the dissonance, it's the disconnect, it's the paradox that creates a deeply inspirational flow of consciousness, and it comes into language and design and mirroring things of a different world in a way. And I think it's quite important to allow.
So do you think then that you look for yourself? You describe this loneliness and this emptiness and this wanting to connect. Do you think you look for yourself in different people and different experiences? And is that how you're able to channel these things, is in a way to search for yourself in the world and in other people?
So I think I've sort of, my self-knowledge is that, as I've discovered, contemplative spirituality is my preferred language of prayer. So I enjoy silence.
Explain that for people who have no idea what you're talking about.
So silence is a language.
Right.
And it's a very powerful, sophisticated language that can articulate subconscious and conscious thoughts in a very quick and powerful way. So just sitting and being you can have prayer to God, however you want to, in your own tradition, define that, you can use silence. Mm. And you can use also silence in a relationship where you can just sit and be and allow your essence to touch. Mm. And I think we're afraid of that. And so because we're afraid of silence, we're afraid of intimacy, and because intimacy, we're afraid of intimacy, we're afraid of silence, and they go together. So as silence is my preferred language of prayer, I'm discovering pretty late in life that I find poetry is a expression of my social frustration and my social desire for action and for change.
Speaking of silent, there is kind of a silent undertone about your writing, and now I hadn't been able to kind of pinpoint it before, and it's kind of, it's there in the tone, it's there in how few words you use. My co-host, who's in many ways a lot more intelligent than me, kind of described the structure of the poem as breathless sentences. And you also, there's a lot of full stops, a lot of pauses. In the way that you've written it, it kind of compels you to pause and reflect. Mm. And then you also repeat words like madam and words like, or phrases like at your gate. And you use the word time over and over again. But yes, silent, there's definitely kind of a quiet undertone about it. So I was wondering could you maybe speak to the tone of the poem and the structure and what your thinking was behind that?
Not easily.
I love it.
Because it would imply that there was thought given to it, and there wasn't. You know, it was. I was driving. I was deeply moved. Something touched my soul. I sat down in a quiet moment, waiting for my guest, and I wrote this poem, and it was finished. Mm. So to say, to claim that it had some kind of thought to structure, rhythm, pause, it, or even vocabulary. I can't claim that.
Okay. Well, that's certainly something that seems very methodical and deliberate. So I want to credit you for that. But I also think, I think there's a lot to learn from that. Even though it was a happy accident, I think a lot of our discourse in this country is very noisy. A lot of what we read, a lot of the words we use, very, very noisy. And it's hard to stop and reflect because it goes back and forth and back and forth. And everyone's trying to get a word in and everyone's trying to explain. Yeah. So do you think there's for writers, any writer, for a journalist, for an author, even for people in dialogue, do you think there's a strength in silence, in thinking about silence?
Yes, because when you write, you're a voice. And I think the power lies in authenticity and integrity. So when you write, you have to reach down within yourself to find your true voice. Mm. And if your mind is filled with your audience and it's filled with structure and format, and then it doesn't connect. But if you completely oblivious to that and you reach down deep within yourself and you find your inner voice, the best way of describing your inner voice is like if you stand in the veld and you waiting for a wild animal to emerge. You've got to be very quiet because they're skittish. And if you just rest long enough, this wild animal comes out of the mist and you can confront it. And that is who you are. And that is your inner voice. The rest is noise. The rest is very constructed around human ego and human expression. But there's something deeper than that.
That's so beautifully described because you've spoken to something that is actually so primal, but is definitely in us.
Yes.
You know?
It's a voice.
Because we used to hunt animals. And I think with evolution, human beings have become more wordy, more noisy. Mm-hmm. But we used to exist in kind of relative quiet, you know, even before the existence of language. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think you've tapped into something there, that we often don't think about when we're trying to communicate. We kind of get lost in the words.
And that's where beauty lies, in that authentic, real voice.
So you're saying the words will come if you're able to access that place.
It's
mystic. Then the words are kind of...
It's mystical in the sense that although there's a clear methodology, the inspiration cannot be purely explained in method. So I think...
So the words for you are completely incidental, and the structure, it's just about accessing that place, and then it pours out?
Yes. So I do executive coaching. So, for example, when I'm working with a leader, I try to mirror for them that they must look through me and they must find their own true voice, because in that voice has been downloaded everything they need for leadership. Because leadership is always a tension between envisioning the dream and managing the nightmare. So the leader holds that space. And so they have to find within themselves the ethics, the innovation, the inspiration, the grace to relationally hold people. They have to deal with their loneliness because they can't constantly need affirmation, validation. They have to be independent. They have to lead. And they have to lead not from an ego power charismatic base, but from a deeply rooted ethical direction base. To do that, they have to find themselves. And so
it's incredible.
And everybody has that. And I'm excited when I got that from learning to work with children. I work with child-headed households, and each child has that. And so they're defined by their poverty, by their suffering, by the grief, by the loss, by post-traumatic stress disorder. All those labels are there. And I'm not diminishing their significance, but that child has their own voice. Mm. And I think that is the greatest gift, is to relate in community to help us find each other's voice. So at a broader narrative, what we want in South Africa is we want to sit in community and say, let's hear each other, let's find each other's inner voice, the true voice, because that's where integrity authenticity lies, and that's where we can relate.
Absolutely.
And move forward.
Absolutely. I love that. And just to bring it back to domestic work, I think you'll be really good at answering this question. If there are men out there, because men in general are kind of least associated to this space. The kind of archetype is the madam domestic worker relationship, you know, and you use the title madam in your poem, and that's kind of the conditioning, right? Is that women or madams are seen as kind of the authority or the proverbial patriarch in the domestic worker realm. And so we've had very few men on the show, for instance, because a lot of men just don't seem to think it has anything to do with them. So if there are men out there who perhaps don't know how to relate to their domestic workers, right? Or if they have a role to play, despite their best intentions, I have two questions for you. First of all, and this is kind of what you've spoken about, how can they go about it? You know, what is kind of the gateway to empathy and to relating in that relationship?
Oh, that's a complex question. I don't know, to be honest. I can't speak. I mean, it's this dilemma. I can't speak on behalf of...
For you.
For me, well, we don't have servants in our home because of the pain and because of the complexity. We just, we in our home, because of my pain of my childhood, we don't have that. So I've dealt with that, the contradictions and the complexity of that, by not having those relationships.
But there's definitely...
But that's not a solution to... And there's then what about the ethic of giving employment and...
Right.
So there's a, if everybody just said we don't have servants in the home because it causes pain and because of dissonance and because of power paradigms and complexity, then we'd have a lot of people unemployed, and the informal sector is very vulnerable.
Sure.
So it's not an ideological, political discourse. This is something quite intimate, and I think
it's very personal.
You can't really have one as one size fit all. I think men, so to say, I don't know whether we can just say men. What it's just in my sense, homes are intimate spaces where so this delineation between the man, the woman, the male, the female, the madam, the absent boss or father figure. I mean, all of these things are very stereotypical, and I don't think they apply. Every home is so differently configured and different dynamics. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all. I would say the relationship in a home is where we learn to relate in a nation. And it is where we build relational skills, where we build relational intelligence and relational thinking. And it is our learning. So for me, that space has deeply formed me as an individual, as an adult, from my childhood. It was the things that caused me grief and caused me pain. They were negative, but they have shaped me, I think, in a positive way. The framing, the meaning has been given a positive. So we must allow the messiness. I don't think life can be choreographed. The messiness has to be allowed, but we need to find different ways of thinking relationally. And relationally, by that I mean power, values, history, amount of contact, connectivity, the ability to connect with the essence of people beyond just roles necessarily.
What was it about your situation growing up within your home that made you so privy to what a domestic worker goes through? Because it's one thing, I think, and you said this to me earlier, you said the thing about your work is that it's always about something outside yourself. It's always about the subject or the object. You never make it about yourself, right? So I think in a sense it's one thing to reflect on what your domestic worker meant to you, which a lot of people do, and I have as well, right? And I'm very much in many ways, the center of that reflective process. It's one thing to do that. It's another thing entirely to be able to somehow embody what she must have been going through, or she must be going through on a daily basis. And so I'm trying to figure out, I guess, to distill what gave you access to that experience.
I think all people have got a deep need to connect with their true selves. And the true self is timeless, infinity, and but we're trapped in time, we're trapped in a history, we're trapped in a particular narrative. So in all of us, there are children's voices. So my voice is, I can remember really loving this woman, and one day she left, she was upset, she was crying, she left my home. And she was walking down the street, and I can remember running behind her as a small boy, crying, calling out to her. I wanted to connect, and we didn't even have a chance to say goodbye. And so I think.
Do you remember what happened?
Well, I think, you know, there was an altercation between her and my mother, and my mother obviously had the power to decide to dismiss the woman, and she was dismissed, and then she went. So there's something that's not reconciled inside of me, the child with the woman. And so that is just a memory. It's an echo in my soul. And so when I see the woman standing at the gate, the child in me echoes, and I connect at a deep level of attachment and identification. And with that is emotion. And the emotion is what gives poetry authenticity and life of its own.
So is this a poem about her and your mother?
I don't know. I think that poetry have they catch a message, a sound from maybe somewhere else, and then they articulate it through the messenger, and the messenger, and I don't want to use the word contaminate, but they express the message. And the message that they express is obviously framed within their own history, identity, and things like that. So all poems have a characteristic of the poet. But I think it's a mistake to limit poetry to its author, because poetry has a life of its own, and the people that read it give it life of its own for them. And that's the beauty of creating language and poetry and meaning like that.
And I think that's part of the strength of this poem, is that you haven't loaded it with your personal experience. You know, there's just so much left to the imagination, and there's so much we can kind of all latch onto.
The poem is layered. And I didn't realize that when I wrote it.
But
so the first layering
all is... All this accidental technique. I love it. Go ahead.
So the first part is... You know, it's this to wake, to wash, to walk, text. It's got this movement. And then
it does dance a little bit, huh?
Yes, and then there's waiting. So it's the movement and then the waiting. So there's the tension of that. And then and then it moves. It's really, you get the sense of the woman standing at the gate. You have a picture of her. Another friend of mine who read the poem thought it was a man standing at the gate. It was a gardener.
Interesting.
Yeah. So
really?
So you have this dynamic.
Do you make reference to gender at any point?
No.
Huh.
So we're assuming this. But it was a woman at the gate.
Right.
So the one layering is you get this picture of it could be a race issue.
Right.
But then it shifts to a class issue. You know, your color may change. While your color may change, I will still be at your gate. So it becomes a class issue. But what I like about the poem, if I can say I like it.
You're more than welcome to. We all do.
What I like about it is the end, where it says, but I am, madam, on time. And that speaks to me of the fork in the road. Are we going to go for some kind of social reform, or are we going to go for some kind of social revolution? Because it's brewing. It's like it's pregnant. The nation is pregnant with frustration and servitude and anger. And it's brewing and it's bubbling, and there's injustice, and the injustice is just flowing structurally into different different class structures and political elite systems, but the color's changing, but it's still the same. There's an inherent sense of injustice that the poor always get the raw deal, and they are frustrated, and like this woman at the gate, they are on time for change. And what change we're going to have, I don't know.
Who is late?
The status quo always protects their interests, and it delays societal change and transformation. And so what is late is transformation in this country.
Okay. And so you're saying that real transformation goes beyond the aesthetics.
Transformation is essentially the transforming ourselves from our time to our infinite, and finding our true voice, and I believe, and then from that spiritual transformation of, I believe, relating to God and finding a tradition that you believe in, then from that you translate into relational, intimate family transform, and then your circles, your relational circles transform. But eventually transformation lies in structure, in systems, in nations, the political economy of a country. And in this transformational journey, there's always this tension between the nightmare and the dream.
So do you think that we have an aesthetic relationship with transformation?
Well, I think it's like a railway track.
When you speak about the only thing that changes being essentially aesthetic, a color.
It's because there hasn't been a class change.
Mm. And I wonder if there's
We still got a working, informal working class that are suppressed and struggling.
And I wonder, because you know what? The thing I know, and we've learned about domestic work through this process, is that it cuts across classes, social classes, and it cuts across racial divides as well, right? Very rich people have domestic workers. Middle class people have domestic workers. We've often heard domestic workers who will essentially employ a childminder or a domestic worker so that they can go to work.
Mm.
So do you think that speaks to something more? And then across those divides or those categories, domestic workers are treated the same.
Yeah, for me, it's about servanthood. I mean, as a diplomat, I always thought I was a servant in a manor house, sort of 18th century manor house. You're in the gentry's residence, but you're a servant. You have access to the gentry, but you're not gentry. So you're a civil servant, you're a public servant that has access to power, to the political elite, the business elite, but you remain a kind of peripheral. And so I experience the servanthood at a different level, and I think that there's something honorable, there's something that we mustn't diminish and demean and devalue about being a servant.
Mm.
And I think that in our kind of society where we have this upward mobility, we have this assumption that success is upward mobility.
Right.
And so, but my experience, for example, in diplomacy, which is really most of my life was formed from that, is that we got all these titles. We call your holiness for the Pope, your eminence for a cardinal, your grace for a bishop, kings and queens are your majesty, your excellency, your royal highness, all these titles that are deeply spiritual, yet we give them to people. And yet my understanding is that the more power you have, the more knowledge, the more educated, the more money, and the more influence you have, the more responsibility you have as a servant to serve the marginalized and the vulnerable. That's my worldview. And so I see the world through that lens. And so, so I don't have I don't like a paternalistic, patronizing attitude towards the marginalized and the oppressed, because it devalues their dignity, the value of their work, their worth. So I think there's a tension in this discussion.
In the same token, do you think there is a power and a strength to domestic workers as servant that isn't attributed to them.
Yes.
In that role.
Yes, and I think that they have access to intimacy. They're coming into intimate spaces and places. They're picking up the emotional, relational vibes between the adults. They're in the emotional spaces with the children. They're loving. They're caring. And a lot of these women have faith. And so they, when they're there, they're praying and they're bringing the presence. They're bringing presence into a home. They're bringing something. They are a carrier of something in the home. And yet they're not, because they're not recognized and they're not seen, doesn't mean that what the presence that they're carrying isn't of incredible value. And I think it is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Couldn't have said it better myself. And towards closing, I first want to ask you, what do you hope people will feel when they read this poem? And I'd like you to give me that answer in three words. Three feelings.
To reflect. To feel. And then to be.
Fantastic. I'm dying to ask a follow-up question, but I'm not going to. I'm going to leave it at that. Because I think I should. Okay, and then lastly, Robert, why do you care?
So, you know, we started this discussion in Bali with a poem, so you're indulging me to close with a poem, and I appreciate the indulgence.
Of course.
So I was asked this question, why am I as a white man involved in caring for black children? And the question was asked in a way that it was...
For black children or for black people?
No, I'm working with childhood households.
Okay.
In my NGO space. So, okay. And it made me feel ashamed. And I didn't understand why was I feeling this. I wrote this.
Okay.
They question why I care. The stare. Deep within my soul of shame. Historical purgatory. Constructed theology. I cringe at the thought, pejorative. Nowhere to hide, to go, exile deferred. My home, my place in time, my heart sublime. Can you not see beyond rhetorical dysentery, my God I love? His lens I find, I look, neglected child, alone, free from fascist control, racial hyperbole. I run, respond, race of grace, to find my own eternal place. Stare no more. Let's leave our own mediocrity, self-obsession, neurosis defined, and stand beyond the walls of bigotry.
Gosh, you have such an honest and an open and a powerful way of reflecting. For the Philistines amongst us, do you want to just briefly... tell us what you're saying in that poem.
So I think that we are staring at each other, and how we stare matters a lot, the attitudes of our hearts. And we all have a sense of shame, I think, for different reasons. I think for historically South Africa, it's trapped in a racial code, and I have a sense of that, being white, and I reflect on that. And there's a sense of historical purgatory. It's as if I've been placed in a waiting. You know, purgatory is a theological concept. And I feel like I've been trapped in a place of purgatory, put there so that I could be redeemed. But it's a constructive theology. And it makes me cringe. It's pejorative because it takes away my essence. I have nowhere to hide. I can't escape. I can't escape my color. I can't escape my history. I can't escape my name. And yet I don't want to go into exile because it must be deferred. So there's also a prophetic layering here of saying, you know, the prophets and the poets often speak to the power with truth, and then when they fail, and they often fail, they go into exile on donkeys, like Jeremiah who escaped into Egypt. I have a sense of that. But my home, this is my home. in the south in Africa, so it's my place in time. I'm here only for a short time, from cradle to grave, but it's where I've been located. It's my history. It's where I'm implanted, and it speaks to my heart. And I ask the question: can you not see beyond rhetorical dysentery? It's this incredible wordiness of this racial discussion. It's rhetorical, and it's like dysentery. It just pours out. And yet, my God, I love. It's his lens I find. I look, and then I see the neglected child alone, free from fascist control. So, I have a fear of when you don't deal with justice appropriately, it creates a vacuum, and it pulls into that vacuum violence. And violence promises this illusion of change and transformation. But with all violence, it just breaks and creates more and more pain and more destruction. And the people that they're trying to redeem and save, they just experience more pain and more destruction. And in this racial hyperbole, we fixated in South Africa. We can't see each other because we got this hyperbole, this exaggerated sense. Without diminishing, but it's exaggerated. I run, respond, race of grace. It's like this sense of urgency to find my eternal place, to find a voice, to speak, to say, let us be, let us connect, let us see each other. Let us stare no more and leave our own mediocrity, this self-obsession, our neuroses defined, narcissistic, and stand beyond the walls of bigotry. So that's really, I think, I like this poem. My son, he's done a commentary on my poetry, and he writes that he's quite critical. He says, he talks about it being a white liberalist poetry addresses sites of contradiction and conflict in a post-apartheid.
Sure, he doesn't hold
Africa.
Back, eh?
He says, stemming from the shame of whites who feel to be at war with their own community and their own ancestors.
Oh, wow. He says, you have raised him to be honest.
He says the style goes further to capture the same source of conflict within the self as whites come to understand white privilege and are confronted by it, leading to self-alienation.
Huh.
And I think that, I mean, I'm proud that he can be critical of the poetry and that he has his own voice.
So that's amazing then, because that actually, I was trying to figure out how to put this question. I was going to ask you, what is your wish for white South Africans? Then I thought, no, what is your wish for the next generation? Then I thought, no, what is your wish for all South Africans? But I think your son, just a relationship with your son is a great way to capture it. So through your work, through your reflections, through your parenting, right? Through your being, what have you tried to convey to your son about this country and about these issues? And what do you hope to convey?
I think we have violence in us. And we don't know how to address that violence. And so we relationally articulate it in different ways, from passive-aggressive to domineering, bullying, to many, many wrong ways that cause pathology. I think we need to find ways of dealing with our own violence in us and then to live a more gentle, kind, grace-filled, loving way that is not as judgmental, as critical, and using language to cause pain, because language is beautiful. It's created with meaning for framing and for beauty.
How old is your son?
I've got four children. I've got a daughter, 24, son, 22, and the son who wrote this is 20, and I've got a little girl of 10.
Okay. And what is your wish for them? Is that your wish for them, is what you've just articulated, to kind of address that inner violence and to come to a place of
yes,
harmony?
Yes, I think they've got a vocation. They've got an identity and a purpose and a calling that's bigger than just the short time in time. And I think my greatest hope, as with my children, as with anybody, is to help them find the inner voice and to connect with that inner voice and then to live a brave, courageous life and live it to the full. Love generously, extravagantly, forgive easily, and be honest. Don't be trapped in a cage of needing constant affirmation, validation, but rather give it because it's so short in supply.
Thank you so much. And I think that's a beautiful way to end. Thank you so much for joining me. This has been truly a privilege. And I want to thank you for this piece that we spoke about today, the piece that you finished with, but for your work in general. I really think it's such a service to our country. So thank you.
Thank you, Mbali.
And for more of Robert's beautiful work, you can visit his blog. It's robertbuerta.blog. Is that correct? And you'll find more of these pills and more of these reflections on that platform. And we'll post that on our social media pages as well. Our Twitter page is @MAIDEproject. That's M-A-I-D-E project. And our Facebook page is The Maid Sessions. That's M-A-I-D-E Sessions. Thank you so much for joining us today. We will catch you later.
Cliffcentral.
I've got something important to tell you.
Cliffcentral.com.